Hello, this is Chuck from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. Poet, songwriter, author, and educator Reggie Gibson has performed and lectured at schools, universities, and theaters nationally and internationally. His work has appeared in New Line Cinema film Love Jones, based largely on events in his life. Reggie works with world music band Atlas Soul. He is a former National Poetry Slam individual champion, has been regularly featured on NPR, and has appeared on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam. He currently teaches and inspires through his unique project Shakespeare to Hip Hop, and you can read about that at shakespeare2hiphop.com. Ron and I have actually played with Reggie a few times with the Butler Frogs. He's a very talented and thoughtful guy. So here is our conversation with Reggie Gibson, recorded at Woods Hill Table in Concord, Massachusetts.
I didn't realize before meeting Reggie that he's not only a musician, but he's many other things, and he wears many hats. When I was looking into more about you after just knowing you a little bit, was that I didn't realize that you emigrated from Chicago initially. One of the things that struck me was that the poetry and the people that you met and worked with out in Chicago were sort of a family of people, it seems like.
Yeah. Pretty tight.
When it started in Chicago and you brought you here, I was so struck by the fact that these guys and gals put together some of your work, and actually as a send off to go to your next journey, they did some of your own poetry.
Yeah, they did some of my stuff. Part, you know, respectful send off, part roast, that kind of thing. Yeah, it was really good of them to do that. And I miss a lot of those cats. It was good to be loved.
Yeah.
Sometimes you don't know it till you actually get the hell out, you know.
Speaking of those various hats, as a teacher, as a poet, as a musician, do you feel that during different times of your life you feel more like one than the other?
Yeah, there are times I feel, well, I have to be more academic than the performative part of myself. Then there are other times when I feel more performative rather than academic. But those are always exchanging, interchanging. It's an interesting question. I don't really write as much, I would say, poetry for myself in that sense anymore. The stuff that I feel, the stuff that I'd like to mostly talk about, that kind of thing, I don't do that as much as I used to. I don't write all the time now from what's in my soul, quote unquote, but I try to bring my soul to whatever it is I write. So therefore, I have that catharsis of still being able to communicate truthfully.
Does it go hand in hand?
Yeah. Well, I think so. I don't think they need to be strange bedfellows, as, you know, that used to be the case in the 90s. There was this huge sort of rivalry, some people would put it, between performance poetry and academic poetry. And it was thought that the two cannot coexist, whereas the performance poets were much more concerned with how something actually moved people. The academic poets were concerned with what was going to have lasting value. So the idea was something anyone could pick up, you know, 100 years from now, and it would exist without the individual who wrote it being there. Whereas the performative aspect was, well, maybe some of what we're talking about has to exist in the now of it being performed. Particularly given that for the vast majority of our tenure on this planet as human beings, we've been an oral species. You know, this thing of writing is relatively new in the whole arc of our existence on this planet.
You know, when someone writes an academic poem, that person is not always a performer, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. At least they don't think they are. Often, I've seen this, where there are poets who don't give as much care to how it's being said as to how it was written.
Yeah.
But I often hold that the moment you decide to make it something airborne, it becomes a phenomenon in the world. And once you make something a phenomenon in the world, any act of communication is an act of performance. It's a speech act. Right. You're hoping to affect something other than what's in your own head. And so that means that there is going to be an exchange, and we can say the same word several different ways and communicate something very different. So yes, it's a choice, though they don't always know it. They are doing a performative act, but they don't think about it that way.
Well, the performance can really affect whether the audience is understanding anything you're saying.
Oh, absolutely. Too, absolutely.
Right? Yeah. So you can sit there and you can recite a poem just monotone, mm-hmm. and it's got nothing. But if you're up there and you're performing that,
right,
then they just get it, whether it be visceral,
yeah,
or they understand the word that you're saying.
Right.
I mean, a lot of times they may not.
Absolutely.
But they can kind of understand it depending upon the performance.
True that. Because we human beings communicate on multiple levels, actual syntax, words being just one of them.
I'm going to bring up hip hop now.
Sure.
I'm not an expert, but I do know.
You're not? You sure?
You couldn't tell by that time, man?
could have sworn you were, but I'm sorry.
I know. The outfit gives it away.
I know. LL Bean, yeah, I know that.
But I. You haven't heard my LL Bean rap?
No. No.
You have an LL Bean rap? That's awesome.
You mean you don't?
It started in Freeport.
Oh, please don't.
In 1912, no, the same year.
Please just stop.
It's a Titanic.
Stop it now.
Okay. So anyway, when you think about different modes of communication, we're talking about kids and talking about how you don't need to even speak, but there's a feeling of the beat with hip-hop.
Right.
And then there's a feeling of the prosody of some of the words that come across.
Right.
And even though the content is so important, like if you read classic hip-hop chart topper, if you read the lyrics on his page, you could be moved by that.
Mm.
But then there's something about putting that, as you said, orally out with a beat and with a feel.
Absolutely.
When you create something, you create words.
Right.
What does it do for you when it becomes more of a groove or a hip-hop piece?
Well, I think there's a power to it. There's a focus that tends to happen when you add rhythm. It also creates an expectation in hip-hop that there will be a rhyme. And if that expectation is fulfilled successfully, and by successfully, I mean that it's actually within the meter, maybe unexpected what the rhyme might be. It might surprise you. And so therefore, if it's fulfilled successfully, then there is a pleasure, you know, that tends to come from that. Also, given that the basis of all music is the heartbeat, you know, that we understand for ourselves. And that's the first sound we heard, you know, floating around as little water creatures inside of mama. First thing we heard is a heartbeat, right? That's our original boom, 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 boom. That's our GPS. It lets us know what's going on.
Right.
And for many of us, what we heard after that, we heard the voice of community. So maybe it's something like... And all we hear, we don't know what's being said. We understand that as an occurrence of sound, which is happening outside of the womb. But inside of the womb, what we're hearing is rhythm. And so when we come out, I think we have a natural pulling toward language and how language can also derive a profound meaning by having it encased in rhythm. And so hip-hop tends to do that. And so I think when we hear it, we hear anything that's rhythmic, even if it's not hip-hop, but it's hip-hop-esque, let's say Johnny Cash, who, you know, for all intents and purposes, you know, he's a rapper with a guitar. You listen to what Johnny Cash is talking about. Right. It's like, oh, okay, he sets up this rhythm. And he basically talks his way through it. And we love him. And he's one of the greatest songwriters that we've ever produced.
Because his instrument not only is the guitar, but his instrument really is the voice.
It's the voice.
And the prosody of the rhythm of his voice and the lyrics.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he uses the guitar to augment that.
Yeah.
He uses the guitar as a percussive instrument a lot of times in order to augment what it is that he's doing.
Yeah, it's cool.
And then he captures that in story, in narrative. That's one of the things I think is most successful. Like when we talk about some of the best chart toppers in hip hop and some of the ones who have lasted the longest, they've been able to create narrative in their work. And we human beings need a story. We're the storytelling species. And so usually if you can get a killer groove, groove being, you know, also the bass line as well as the rhythm, something of a memorable melody, and someone with a voice that doesn't turn you away, but also can tell a really tight story, it tends to climb up the charts pretty well.
You know, it's interesting because I was just listening. I just pulled out the Royal Scam. I was listening to Steely Dan.
Yeah.
The last couple of days, and the lyrics in those songs, it's definitely a story, and you can feel that grab you when there's more of a story. Mm-hmm. Even though the music is great, but when there's a story, it definitely pulls you on in a different direction.
It keeps you there. Keeps you there, like Charlie Daniels, right? Devil Went Down to Georgia. Mm-hmm. You know, he's basically rapping.
Right.
That's what he's doing. Devil went down to Georgia, and they're looking for a soul to steal. I mean, it's basically what he's doing, and that is the largest selling, one of the largest selling country singles ever.
That's interesting because you always wait for the next verse for that song.
It sets up that anticipation, which I think a particular song like that delivers admirably.
We really jumped into some deep stuff really quickly.
Okay.
It doesn't usually happen with
Bridges.
Should we get shallow?
We usually get deep after everyone leaves. I don't even know what the hell that means.
I don't want to contemplate what that means.
I don't want Joe to help you out.
I'll delete that one right out of the podcast.
Don't let Joe help you with that one.
Anybody but Joe?
Pretty much.
Hey, that's a good name for a band.
Yeah, anybody but Joe.
Anybody but Joe.
That's a good name for a band.
Yeah.
We were looking over our notes about you, like in your history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we touched briefly about your roots in Chicago.
Yeah.
And I know this is something you wanted to kind of delve into. with your mom and dad and the kind of juxtaposition there.
Your mom, we talked about mom before, I think instilled in you, I don't know if both your parents did, to remember verses. Tell me more about that. Is that a part of your upbringing? Is that something you remember learning?
Yes. I would say if I do the forensics going even further back, but yes, definitely my mom, she being a Jehovah's Witness, they would have us do something called theocratic training, which is learning how to speak to people about the Bible, right? And talking to strangers and stuff like that. And so we would study the Bible religiously. And we also learned some rudimentary, much of which I've forgotten, some rudimentary Hebrew, rudimentary Greek, rudimentary Latin, you know, so we could find you people and let you know how you're worshiping the wrong God. You know, we got it right. So we could, you know, we could understand a bit of the Torah, a bit of the Septuagint, the Vulgate, that kind of thing, be able to sort of argue and talk from that perspective. So language was a huge part of that.
When you just mentioned that you were taught how to teach, you were taught how to look someone in the eye and explain to them about what your beliefs are.
Right.
A lot of kids never do that. It just interests me, like, how does that translate into the path that you've taken?
You know, that's an interesting question. I mean, I've often thought, you know, my mother, she wanted me to be more, I guess, a part of the church, teaching and preaching a truth. I still do that, but I just don't do it in any sort of sectarian way, you know, no prescribed religious way.
I'm even taking the religion out of it.
Right.
I think that it's the process of a human being verbally connecting to another person and making an impact on that person.
Oh, yeah.
Which a lot of people can't do.
Yeah, I got what you mean. It's just she wanted me to do it one way, and I did it another way. Yeah. But yeah, the whole thing of talking to another human being, which I fear we're getting away from in our culture. I fear that we're stepping away from that. But maybe it's part of our evolution.
So then there's also your father who was a police officer, correct?
Yeah. For a significant part of the time I was growing up, my father, he did eventually leave the force. But for a significant part of my time, my formative years, my dad was a police officer.
So now how did that kind of juxtapose against the vibes you're getting from your mom?
Man, I always talk about that as being, you know, I was raised somewhere between a fear of God and a fear of man. Both of them respected study to a degree. Mm. My mother was always about be peaceful as long as it depends on you. And my father's idea was when somebody steps to you, you fire them up as quickly as you can. And you make it so that this individual never wants to lay their hand on you twice. So there were those conflicting. There was to turn the other cheek, and then there was to make sure that guy has no cheek left to turn. And so it was, I wouldn't say difficult, but it's been a thing that I've, through my life, have had to always sort of deal with. When to be more of a peaceful individual, when to be a bit more assertive, and sometimes when to get physical.
Can you elaborate on how that may have pushed you towards writing poetry and maybe the subject matter or just the feeling of what you were writing when you were younger?
Yeah, I think so. And I look at that as also a pattern in my life. You know, my father was very secular in his belief. My mother was very spiritual in hers. And it was the same way with my great-grandparents. And my great-grandfather, Robert, was illiterate. He could not read. And he was the guy who was the caller on the railroad. That's the guy who would sing so that people could work and hit the nail.
Hit the spike.
And
amazing.
I can tell you a quick one. He was extraordinarily secular, and he would sing this song, one of the songs that he wrote. I don't know he wrote it, but he wrote it in his head. My brother and I, we were at his house that he had built in Mississippi. I was about 6 years old. He was about 5 years old. And the song was a song he sang on the railroad. I am working now, all day long, Lord. Here comes the sun, traveling tracks of sky. Oh, Lord. And we would hear that song, and it struck me differently this one particular time because my great-grandmother was in the front room, and she was shucking peas or knitting or whatever it was, or chewing tobacco, which she loved to do. And, and she was singing what I would later come to understand as a gospel song, and it was, I want Jesus to walk with me. I want Jesus to walk with me all along life's pilgrim journey. I want Jesus to walk with me. You know, we had heard her sing that song, my brother and I, too. But this particular time, while we were in the room, this little shotgun house that he built, those two songs, my great-grandfather's secular work song and my great-grandmother's spiritual song, they merged.
Yeah, I could hear it when you just did that.
Right. It was like, I am working, Jesus, walk with her, traveling tracks of all along my, and it was like, and my brother and I, we sort of turned to each other. We still talk about that moment, you know, and now, you know, he's a granddad, you know, and we still talk about that. And when I go back and think about that moment in time, I think that's probably a place where a lot of things started for me. And I think that's what it is for a lot of us who do music, a lot of us who do singing. There's a sound that we're trying to get back to. There's the parts of us that we perceive as separate, but there's a space in which there is no separation. There's a space when it seems seamless and it seems whole to us, right? So when I see that as my great-grandmother and her spiritual part, and my mother and her spiritual part, and I look at my great-grandfather and his secular part, and my father and his secular part, I just described who they were, you know? Yeah. Which is kind of where I am, as I said to you guys. You know, I do a lot of work with my church, but at the same time, you know, I have been called a DNA, which is a damn near atheist. There's a need for spiritual community, but there's the need for sweat.
And you're the amalgam between the two.
I try to walk that line, you know, as much as I just walk that line. I think mostly even in my work.
Bridge Over Troubled Waters was founded in 1970 to serve runaway, homeless, and high-risk youth, most of whom have been abused and neglected throughout their lives. The agency was among the first in the nation to recognize and respond to the growing population of homeless youth, a phenomenon which was to become a national issue. For 47 years, Bridge has been a national model and program innovator for youth development services, reaching youth where they're at, helping them overcome the effects of abuse and neglect, and assisting them to prepare for and attain training, jobs, and economic security. Today, as the premier agency in Boston serving homeless youth, Bridge provides its wraparound continuum of care approach to services for 3,000 youth each year. To read more about their services or to learn how to get involved and support Bridges, go to bridgeotw.org or go to abovethebasement.com and click on our charitable causes page.
Let's get into that a little bit, dive into the work a little bit, because, you know, we're really impressed with Shakespeare and hip-hop. And back to your various hats of being a teacher and being a poet. What is your take on the growth of this program? And
you're talking about the Shakespeare to hip-hop program?
Yeah.
It's been bananas, you know, lately. I mean, my group, we bring together classical texts with modern music and contemporary music. We also do commentary, modern-day updating and commentary on those classic texts. And we want this to be something that younger people and also a modern audience can really climb into and really, really feel. So Shakespeare is really the sort of controlling, I guess, entity/deity of what it is that we do, because there was never, in my looking at the world, been someone who, in English, who brought together rhythm and language and narrative and scope and story and psychology and all of that into the English language. And what we've been doing, we've been working a lot with the library, the Boston Public Library, for the last 6 months, a exhibit called Shakespeare Unauthorized, and they contacted us to do some original programming for it. So we've been in residence at the library since October. Now we're going out into other places. We're doing a lot of schools, educational places, even churches have been calling saying, hey, can you guys come over and do this Shakespeare to hip hop kind of thing.
Yeah. What's your background in Shakespeare? I mean, that's tough stuff. I mean, that's not. Oh. And also, you don't even just do Shakespeare, from what I understand. You also do the Greek.
Homer to hip hop.
We thought about Homer to hip hop.
Didn't have anything to do with The Simpsons.
But see, that was the issue, is when we wanted to call it at first Homer to hip hop. Right? Yes. Because of the concentration that we do on Greek myths at times. But when you put Homer, of course, in Google, what comes up? Homer Simpson.
Oh, really?
Yeah, most 75% of the time, it's Homer Simpson that comes up.
I'm not surprised. So
we didn't want to be painted with that. So it's like, all right, well, Shakespeare to hip hop as well.
What is your background there?
How did I come to it?
Just knowing Shakespeare and knowing Homer, and that's not easy stuff.
No. It's not. In fact, I wrote something. Believe it or not, even once I thought Shakespeare a genius. I mean, I'd read that Renaissance English, and it would make me a little squeamish, hesitant, reticent to engage with the gent. And like I said, when I tried to read him, I couldn't quite get what he meant. But after some digging in his plays and his poetry, it became apparent that he really knew humanity. And now I dig whether on stage, page, or screen, and in almost each stanza and well-crafted scene, he makes language sing. So this is a list of my favorite Shakespearean things. Lady Macbeth and the Moor named Othello. Shylock of Merchant, he's that Jewish fellow who said, if you prick us, do we not bleed? Richard III's frantic search for a steed. All's well that ends well is always a pleaser. So's Antony's soliloquy, he says, over Caesar and Bottom's head in a Midsummer Night's Dream. These are my favorite Shakespearean things when I'm tired, uninspired, and my soul needs wings. I open myself to Shakespeare's plays and poems and then listen to English Swing.
Oh, yeah.
That's excellent.
So it does take a while for it to break through, but it's like with anything once you get used to it. And also reading commentary. It helps. Reading commentary for me helps me to really understand the tougher parts. I mean, some of it is part of the reasons I think we don't understand Shakespeare as much. Is, of course, it has to do with archaic language.
And the way it's written down.
And the way it's written down and the floweriness of it. But a large of it is the allusions. We just don't get what he's talking about because we no longer use these allusions, you know, in the way that he does. Like, if he talks about, you know, Phaeton, or he talks about someone who flies through the airy skies and blah, 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 it seems flowery to us. But that audience, who was an audience that was a lot closer to an ancient narrative, an ancient understanding of a narrative, got what he meant, right? And for us, it doesn't work the same. If we can hook into the metaphor, if we can hook into the illusion, if we understand what's going on, then it opens up a whole other vista. Keep in mind that our engagement with Shakespeare was primarily visual. I mean, when it was written, it was not meant to be read. The people who read it, if they did read it at all, were the actors.
Well, what I think is amazing is the iambic pentameter.
Yeah.
Right? So you like that, Chuck?
I think you mispronounced it, though. Yeah.
So
pentameter.
I have an L.L. Bean poem that is iambic pentameter.
Who doesn't?
Anyway, so that is a natural rhythm. And the fact that you're combining hip-hop with Shakespeare is not a coincidence.
No.
Both are different eras of rhythm.
When we talk about Shakespeare, I spend a bit of time, I would say, on the iambic pentameter part of it. After a while, you get to hearing it if you engage with it more and more. I normally have students use drums, and that way they sort of get it. It's the offbeat. And after a few minutes of playing that, you kind of got it. And then if we want to do other rhythms, which Shakespeare played with but didn't really stick with, like trochaic rhythms, which is a stressed beat and then an unstressed beat. They play that and they start to understand that one better. The thing is that it's difficult to really understand music by strictly seeing it on the page. It's something that needs to be in the air and become a visceral experience that a person feels. And when we're talking about rhythm, it's that same way. When students play it, they get it. And when they feel it on their bodies, they understand it as stressed, unstressed, or unstressed and stressed. And that goes back to the way the ancient Greeks used to also work. The dactylic hexameter, which is the epic rhythm of the ancient Greeks, and you hear it in this. It's a long, short, short, long, short, short, long, short, short. They didn't really have stresses and use stresses in the way we do. But when you understand the language of it, like the first verse of the Iliad, men and naed they are peleadeo achilleos. You know, that sort of beat, which sounds very country. You know, and they used to play it also and beat it out in rhythm so that it was more than just in the language, but it was also in the music. And when you had the Corybantic priests, many times they would beat the rhythms on themselves in praise of Dionysus. So I try to bring my students into the understanding of that, you know, play with your body as far as beat the rhythm on your chest, beat the rhythm with your hands. And then you can understand better how to hear it and understand it in language.
That's fascinating because it's such that rhythm that you can kind of just catch on. It's in songs you hear every day.
Everywhere, all the time.
And once you connect that to the physical part of drumming and the beat in your head, then it's not so foreign anymore.
It's demystified. You know, I think part of it is that we make these things difficult sometimes for people to understand, and maybe that's because it keeps many of us academics working. If we can befuddle you, but I don't believe in that. There are too many things which are confusing. Let's not make music and language and speech and connection with one another more confusing.
Right.
You know, let's try to demystify this.
What are some of the effects you're seeing, if any? Or do the kids get better grades? Do they sort of get inspired to read the Iliad and other works because they were inspired by hip-hop and
Shakespeare? I've had at least three students who've contacted me who are in college who want to make classics their study. And Shakespeare to hip-hop, some of the schools we go into are neighborhoods that college, let's just say, might not be something that's on their radar.
Uh-huh.
We've had several students who've said, hey, I was never wanting to go to college and really study before, but now I think I want to. And then people have contacted us and says, hey, I did this. I applied this particular thing that you taught me to my college essay, and I got in. Yeah, so there are a few victories in doing this liberal art type stuff.
Have you had any budding musicians that take what you've taught them and kind of morph it into what they're doing musically?
More in songwriting.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, I myself, you know, you guys mentioned me as a musician earlier. I have way too much respect for musicians to actually call myself one. I'm more of a person.
Oh, please.
Who, you know, I play drums.
Ron calls himself a musician.
You know, yeah, so but he actually showed up with a keyboard, though. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, come on, anybody can own a keyboard.
I wanted Joe to take a picture of it.
I have a keyboard.
but Reggie, but, you know.
I would say I'm a literary musician, if I'm anything else. I tend to work more with words as my primary.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you have the ability, I'm going to use the word chant because it gets back to the biblical too. So you have those inflections and those melodies. You don't have to actually play a guitar or a keyboard to be a musician. And what I've seen in performing with you, but also just a few minutes ago, you dovetailed right into Raindrops on Roses and Whiskers on Kittens.
My favorite things.
But you had your own melody before that you wrote.
I don't know if there's an answer to this. If you'd have an answer to this, but it's something that kind of, I was thinking about poetry.
Yeah.
You won the poetry jam.
Oh, the National Poetry Slam. Some years ago.
You're doing the poetry jam to people who hear poetry all the time. They go, this is their thing.
Yeah.
Do you find that it kind of scares people? I mean, like it's a medium that they don't hear very often unless there's music to it. Or they're seeing something other than just one person up there just saying a poem. Do you find people, they don't know what to do with what they're getting?
I think sometimes.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. You know, people have come up, I don't like poetry, but I like what you did, you know.
They don't like poetry because maybe they've never heard it.
Yeah, or they've been turned off by it. And I think it's because of how it's been taught. And oftentimes it's been taught by teachers who don't want to teach it. But it's a unit in their curriculum and they have to, and that's the way it is. And they spend as little time with it as they possibly can before they move on to Lord of the Flies or something, you know?
Right.
But having people who are passionate about language is something that a lot of people, I don't know if we really experience. And I think it's a matter of speaking truthfully, because so much of the language that we experience now is designed to make us, turn us into tools of consumption, right? Tools of service onto somebody else's paycheck. And so much of what we hear, even in political rhetoric, is language that doesn't communicate truthfully. And we can't really have community unless we can communicate truthfully with one another. I have to, at least, even if I disagree with you, I have to believe you believe it and you have the best intentions in what you speak. But if I don't believe that, then we can't have community. And I think that when it comes down to poetry, depending upon how it's rendered and how it's done, people can say, hey, there's a truth there that I'm feeling. I may not completely understand what you just said, but there's an earnestness, there's a truth there. And I think sometimes it lays them open in ways that other forms of expression don't.
I can imagine when those kids are going into that high school auditorium, they're like a poet.
Oh man, bro, you just don't know. Yes.
I mean, there's got to be, what's the transformation that you see there when you, I mean, certainly it's not everybody, but certainly you must see.
You know, I mean, high school is tough.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, you have the kids and they'll look at you like, I dare you to educate me. The thing about many high school kids is they'll look at each other to determine whether or not it's okay to think this is cool.
Right.
You know, when they start hearing something spoken truthfully, they start to get it. I normally open up with something which is hip-hop, because that's a language in which a lot of these kids communicate.
But, you open up with a groove?
Oh, yeah. If we're doing the Shakespeare thing, I open up with a welcome, playing a funky version of So What? You know, Miles Davis's So What? And come out, and we're in full Elizabethan regalia, and we just start addressing. Like at the library, gentles, one and all, we want to welcome you all to the Boston Public Library. There's here Jim amongst gems in this very diadem that is the city of Boston. So it's almost like a radio announcer. We have it set up so it's like a speakeasy, you know, and it's just a cool daddy-o kind of dude welcoming them into the space. And then right after that, we start going into a piece about how Shakespeare is ubiquitous, is all around us. And then we go into something about the controversies of Shakespeare, and we start bringing in other stuff, hip hop. So we use jazz, funk, blues, country, hip hop in order to do this. Yeah.
This is a very unique idea.
Yeah.
It's about education. It's about the arts. You know, and there's a lot, as you know, in this new era, this new administration, the you know, the NEA is getting hit.
Oh, yeah.
And these are the types of things that I think can be highlighted to show the beauty of the arts and education. They're not just sort of entertainment for an assembly for the sixth graders.
Right.
How they actually are synergistic in how kids learn.
It's extraordinarily disturbing to me about what's happening with the NEA. Some years ago, I was asked to be part of a think tank that the NEA had convened in two places. It was in California and also in North Carolina. And it was called How Art Works. They brought a guy who started Pandora, you know, and a few of us together to talk about structuring quantifiably what art actually does. And we spent days together working this stuff out. So we got all of this work done. We had all of this stuff going on to actually present how quantifiably art helps in critical thinking, how it helps people to facilitate language and blah, blah, blah. And now we have an administration that just doesn't really care for that as much. One might even say it seems to be a concerted effort. Let's just say there may be a certain political nervous river running through our republic that tends to not like critical thinking and tends to want to defund anything that seems to engender critical thinking.
I think that whether or not someone's in favor or not of funding things like this and the NEA in general, taking the politics aside, I think that the Shakespeare and hip hop is just a beautiful example of something, no matter what administration or where we are, should be highlighted because it's a tool.
Yeah, I think so. Anything that can help students to learn. And we put a lot of scholarship into it. It's not strictly just making it cool and entertaining, which we want to do. But our thing is, you know, we research this stuff. We read these books. We go to lectures. You know,
and you bring in the music and the jazz and the funk, and that's what relates to people.
And that's one of the things we're doing, as we want to reinterpret this stuff through American musical forms.
There's some testimonials here. And this is from William Burke, headmaster at St. Sebastian School. I'll just read a couple lines here. What morally courageous, powerfully positive forces for the good, the true, and the beautiful. How richly blessed we are to have you in our lives. I must tell you that I am catching many of our students and teachers saying very nice things about you behind your backs. Phrases such as, that was the best assembly ever echo through our halls.
Yeah.
That's powerful.
Yeah. I'm always gratified to hear that, particularly from educators and people who elect to shepherd and guide our young people.
Remind me, how old are you again when you moved to Boston?
I'm 49, so I was, 32?
So you're 32.
32, 33, yeah.
What have you discovered since you had moved to Boston? You were an older guy when you moved here, so you can really kind of compare the two cities. Chicago's a great city, no doubt.
Yeah, Chicago's a great city. You know, Boston has another kind of energy for me, and it's a good energy. There's less of the Southern thing that I'm used to in Chicago. Mm-hmm. There's much more of an international feel in certain spaces. And there's also the feel of intensified history. I live in Lexington, and we find ourselves now in Concord. What those two poles represent to me is something which is palpable. Lexington is very rich in the beginnings of history in this country. I mean, the church of which I'm a part is the 325th year that the congregation has met. And then here in Concord is centered around so much of the transcendentalist movement of the 19th century, Henry David Thoreau and Emerson, of course, being key in that. And so much of it is centered around here. And that was our first American philosophical movement. And it was a direct heir to the Enlightenment way of thinking. But just as in Lexington, the Minutemen and others said, okay, well, we're not going to deal with England anymore. We just done bam, bam, bam. It was the same way with the intellectual revolution of the transcendentalists. When Emerson called for a bard, a poet who would step forward and would help us to break the chains of England, to no longer be owing anything to Europe. We must now be able to paint the universe in our own colors and something like that. And so, yeah, those two centers of gravity are palpable here, that you don't feel that in Chicago in the same way. You feel the Southern, you feel the jazz, you feel the blues, right? You know, the jazz and the blues are existential, you know, musics of our country, right? So you definitely feel that, but there's another kind of feel here.
You came here, you met someone and moved here. And
yeah, it was very interesting. You know, I was at, I was doing a performance at Longfellow Hall at Harvard. You know, I was a young woman who was in the audience, and, you know, she kept looking at me, I kept looking at her. And then that's where, in fact, I kind of wrote a poem about it, you know? I could probably do it if you want.
Yeah, sure.
Let's hear it.
That March day in Massachusetts, when the second-rate poet from Chicago went shopping for clothes, he never thought he'd buy that black shirt. The one embroidered with the crazy Eastern motif, the one he knew was not his style, the one he figured he would only wear once, yes, the one he did in fact only wear once, yes. The thing only worn once, hanging in the closet next to the other thing only worn once, now hanging in the closet. His main thought was, I wonder how this is going to look on stage this evening. He was vain that way. Likewise, when she of Belmont, Massachusetts, wore that cleavage-clinging pink halter top and ultra-tight pair of black pants, you know, the outfit that screams, damn it, I'm a feminist with a master's degree in education and I demand that men respect me for my mind. Yeah, that one. She was only dressing for a comfortable night out with a girlfriend who ended up flaking on her at the last minute, leaving her to go out alone. She had never been to a poetry reading before, and she had never been anywhere alone. She almost didn't go this time, but then she did. She surprises that way. Now, they did not expect to meet, much less fall into one another and walk that razor-blade-thin, spider-web, frail bridge sometimes built between two people on the verge of finding one another interesting. He was a man who had a rather profound liking for the ladies. All of them. Though he was surprisingly shy about women. Especially that night. She, being from Massachusetts and thus a member of the Frozen Chosen, was not used to speaking to anyone she didn't know, much less second-rate poets from Chicago. But somehow she was a little bit more forward than usual. Yeah, especially that night. Well, stories don't exactly corroborate, but it is generally understood and accepted by both of them that eventually they ended up at IHOP. And over a cup of coffee and a shared rooty-tooty fresh and fruity, he thought, maybe. And she thought, maybe. As for you, well, you were not yet you. That is to say, you were you, potentially. But you were not yet this ever-parasitic tsunami of new discovery fueled by laughter and lactation, leaving broken drinking glasses and ruined CDs in your wake. You were somewhere else, not quite there, a small, curved question mark, faint and forming at the end of some egg named future. Then they loved. And it was good. So they loved again. And during the August of one of those agains, the part of you that had been singing softly and alone inside of her began to sense the part of you that was singing softly and alone inside of him, which began to sense the part of you singing softly and alone inside of her. And those two soft, alone songs began to reach and they found each other and they began to grow and to swell and to sing into one song. You. And after the growing and the singing and the swelling were done, you were lifted from inside the soft dark of her, lifted into light, into scream, into breath. After that, he took you into an empty room, and while no one could see the two of you, he held you above his head. Looked upwards at the ceiling, imagine the ceiling, the fluorescent lights, to be some ocean of greater light stretched endlessly above a land that smelled of salt water and village song. And as must have happened in the lands from which your ancestors came, he brought you close and trembling to his chest, told you what your name would be, thanked his now dead father for your safe passage, then asked for strength and guidance from whatever poet's hand authored all this. So yeah, that's very nice. That's the piece I wrote about us meeting.
That's beautiful.
While I'm here.
Wow.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Interestingly, like, it's called Creation Myth.
Instantly in meditation.
Thank you.
Oh, that was gorgeous.
Yeah, it's funny you. Too. I liked it. Thank you. I want to just briefly talk about Atlas Soul. Because you're not only doing just this for the kids, you've got...
Right.
A creative project with Atlas Soul that you're doing as well, right?
Atlas Soul, we...
Because we talked to... Perry was on.
Oh, Perry was on. Well. Oh, great.
Yeah, yeah. He's an alum.
Good. Yeah, Perry's part of Atlas Soul. Mostly our work is North African. The music is steeped in a lot of North African grooves, North African rhythms. It's more like world spirit. And so with that group, We try to communicate a spiritual, musical sense that brings people together in community. All of us are from different ethnic and cultural backgrounds. As you know, Perry's, you know, his family comes over from Greece.
Yep.
Jacques Pardot, who is the leader of the band, his father was from Greece. His mother was from Algeria. He was raised, born in Paris, but grew up in Israel. So we have all of that. And so I bring sort of a Chicago American, sometimes hip hop, sometimes jazz, sometimes bluesy vibe.
And is Kabir in that?
Najim Kabir, he's one of our drummers. He was the main drummer for a while.
Guy's
and,
sick.
And yeah, he's incredible.
We've heard you do some intermittent spoken word and poetry.
Yeah.
We would love to hear something else, too.
Sure. We'll set you up.
I guess the way I'll just start this off is say, I guess the thing about we poets is that the thing we... Two things we deal with mostly is love and death. The Greeks give us those words, eros and thanatos, right? Love and death. And I think we're trying to get a little bit of the love before thanatos comes and finds us, as it always will. And sometimes I guess living in this existence as being a human being can be tough. And so we've created these tools to help us to manage it. And one of them is philosophy and poetry and music. And I guess this is... in that spirit. Because I guess when we get down to it, there's only one thing we really know, that we love this life, but we all have to leave it at some time. Because here we are in a sea of stars, somewhere between Venus and Mars, short-lived hominids hanging about, doing our best just to figure it out. I said, here we are in a sea of stars, somewhere between Venus and Mars, short-lived hominids hanging about, doing our best just to figure it out. Hey, where do we come from and where do we go? What does it mean to question? What does it mean to know? What is this thing we have deemed as reality? I mean, is it real? Or is it just an imagined fallacy that we all have invented from our collective senses? Is this world merely a screen upon which shadows are beamed as they radiate, emanating from a light screen from behind us? Why does space and time seem to confine us? Is there more to us, or are we all just dust floating in a vat of galactic blackness? Does anybody, I mean, does anybody really, really know what the fact is? Like, is there a being listening to prayer? Or are we alone and there's just nothing there? I don't know the math, but I know somehow one life plus two short equals live your life now. Because here we are in a sea of stars, somewhere between Venus and Mars, lived hominids hanging about, do it now, do figure it out. I say, in a sea of stars, somewhere between Venus and Mars, short-lived hominids hanging about, doing our best to figure it out. And you know, there have been cats who've come along to try to help us with this figuring thing. And I guess when we reach out, we can find them. And some of us know the names: Aristotle, Plato, Zeno, and Parmenides, Epicurus, Augustine, Sartre, and Socrates, Bodhidharma, Gautama, Kant, and Protagoras, Kierkegaard, Hegel, Emerson, and Pythagoras. All of them relentlessly question dimensions that make up the makeup of human existence. We're talking about the manic and the madness, the panic and the sadness, the inner and the outness, the how to be withoutness. You know, the Greeks, they called us Thanatoi, y'all, meaning that our lives are so brief we might as well not even live at all. And isn't that part of what beauty we possess? The fact that we're born in this flesh means we're all really just destined for death. And we're all just borrowing breath that will then pass to another just as soon as we've left. You know, the only moments we have are what the fates allow. Life is lived quick. so you better live now, 'cause here we are in a sea of stars, somewhere between Venus and Mars. Short-lived hominids hanging about, doing our best and just to figure it out. I said, here we are in a sea of stars, somewhere between Venus and Mars. Short-lived hominids hanging about, doing our best to figure it out. That's really what we're trying to do, y'all. We're doing music, we're doing poetry, we're doing song, we're doing all of this because we're trying to figure it out.
Reggie's Shakespeare to Hip Hop project is so fantastic, and if you are interested in more information, go check out ShakespeareToHipHop.com. He's also amazing in Atlas Soul, and you can even catch his TED Talk by Googling Reggie Gibson TED Talk. He also has his personal website at ReggieGibson.com. Go to our website at AboveTheBasement.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends. And remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique. Above the Basement, Boston Music in Conversation is recorded at beautiful Woods Hill Table in West Concord, Massachusetts. Awarded Editor's Choice for Best Farm-to-Table Dining in Yankee Magazine. Woods Hill Table owns a farm in Bath, New Hampshire, where they raise their own meat. They offer a full raw bar and fresh fish caught off the coast of Massachusetts, and they even harvest their own maple syrup and honey for use in the restaurant. Chef Charlie Foster uses international cooking techniques to create fantastic, seasonally focused cuisine. The food is non-GMO and is absolutely delicious. Go to woodshilltable.com for reservations or call 978-369-6300.